Thank you, by the way, for having me here. I think I'm a very loud person, by the way, in general, so I'm not sure the microphone plus my loudness will work out so well. So we'll see how it goes. If I'm too loud, please yell back. Source 1, starting from Tanakh. Uvishnat achat l'choresh melech paras. It was in the first year of the rule of Cyrus, the Median king. He's called the Persian king because the Medians had conquered the Persians at that time, or united them, if you will. L'chlot dvar Adonai mipi Yirmiyahu. In order to complete, or resolve perhaps, the words that God spoke to Yirmiyahu, Hiir Adonai et ruach koresh melech paras. And essentially Cyrus the Great wrote a letter. Now when you see the word michtav, that really means michtav, not like the letters that we have today, which, well, when I was a kid were ink and paper, and now that our kids only have electronic. But here we're talking about cuneiform, written on rock. In fact, this particular words or something similar were in fact found in the Great Cyrus Cylinder, which can be properly dated to 539 to 530. By the way, I have to apologize. We're working in BCE here, of course, because we're in Tanakh. And BCE is really confusing because the dates move backwards. So 539 is earlier than 530. There's a famous joke that historians tell about these cavemen that are sitting around on one caveman's birthday. And the caveman goes, another year and one less candle on the cake. I know historians like that joke. So Cyrus is inspired. And this is actual, that is, you could actually look up, it's in the British Museum. He does, in fact, tell everybody they should go back home and have their own gods. Here the focus, of course, is on the Jewish people. He sounds really firm, right? So the God of the heavens has allowed me to conquer all the lands. For who fakad alai, leave no though by Yerushalayim, I should be done. In fact, he asked me to go, well, if not build a house in Jerusalem, to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and we're talking about the Beit HaMikdash Sheni, to allow it to be rebuilt. Just in case you think he's too firm, the next pasuk will show you a little more about Cyrus's thinking. Mi bachem ichol amo. So who amongst you, from all his nation, that is God's nation, yehi Elohav imo, let God be with you. Vayal liushalayim asher biyudan, go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Ve'yiven et beit Adonai Elohi Yisrael, hua Elohim asher biyushalayim. So that's a little bit more realistic as far as Cyrus. Cyrus certainly believed in God and believed in the Jewish God, but as most of the pantheists of his day, they believed that they were limited to a locality. That is, each land had its own God that could be supreme in its own area. But the bottom line is, it's good news for the Jews. Now, just to give you a little historical background, this is the famous the Yirmiyahu prophecy that Ezra is referring to is the 70-year prophecy. There are, of course, two 70-year prophecies. One 70-year starting from the exile of Yechoniahu. Yechoniahu was dragged out essentially after 3 months of rule by Nebuchadnezzar, by Nebuchadnezzar II. That was about the year 600, maybe a little bit afterwards. And in 586, 587, the temple was destroyed after 11 years of rule of his uncle, Tzidkiyahu. So there are two 70-year cycles. One is 70 years from Yechoniahu's exile, and that's what we're looking at right here. And the other one is the 70 years from the destruction of the temple to the rebuilding of the second temple, which puts the rebuilding of the second temple at about 517. I have to apologize before I start the actual shiur. So I'm new in town. So if I was smart, I would have started slow, right? Give a nice smoozy Tanakh shiur, a little bit on Tisha B'Av. I wouldn't have offended anybody's sensibilities. But I'm not so smart. And it is Tisha B'Av. And I figure that if you can't give a shiur from your heart that is meaningful on Tisha B'Av, even if it's somewhat painful, then when can you give a shiur? On the other hand, what I'm about to do is just give a Tanakh shiur. It's just a Tanakh shiur. However, my first Tanakh Rebbe, or the one who really turned me on Tanakh, was Rabbi Menachem Liebtag. And I still remember his first shiur. If you've gone to the Gush, you always know his first shiur. Starts off Sefer Yoshua. And he compares Milchemet Yericho to the Six-Day War. That's how good it went. And Milchemet Ai, when the Jews got beaten, to the 73 War. So you can immediately sense the kind of approach to Tanakh that Menachem and others have, which is Tanakh is today. Everything that we read in Tanakh is somehow applicable to what we're doing today. So when I say just a Tanakh Shiur, it's a loaded question. I could give just a Tanakh Shiur, which examines the text, without looking for any specific meaningfulness to it. And what's interesting, it's not only Menachem Liebtag, you should know, from the Torani world. It's also Uriel Simon. I don't mean to insult Uriel Simon. Uriel Simon is of course, an Orthodox Jew. Professor emeritus at Bar-Ilan University, but he deals in the scholarly world much more than the Torani world. There are many people in the Torani world who are not comfortable reading Uriel Simon. Uriel Simon wrote a great article where he chides his fellow scholars and say, listen, there's one thing called omnisignificance, which is a word that James Kugel, who is another person who is in the scholarly world, coined, which is every single letter, phrase, you name it, every single letter, if you're Rebbe Akiva, every single tag on the top of the letter has significance. But on the other hand, if you go into the scholarly world, nothing has significance. This old story is about old people. It means nothing anymore whatsoever. You might compare it to what's called the maximalist and minimalist approach, although it's not exactly the same, although you find the camps are on the same side. One hand looks at every single word and says, oh, that means something to me right now, right today. I've got to go and do something. And the other side says that's an old text. So the question is, the truth for us, I think, will be somewhere in the middle. Not that the Torah is not omnisignificant, but the trick about it is to understand how to interpret the prophecies. You know, there were, according to, I believe it's a Medrash in, Shir HaShirim Rabbah, that there were 60 Rebo Nevi'im that gave prophecy. But we're only aware of a very small number of them. What's interesting, you actually meet some. If you open up Divrei HaYamim, which is the Book of Chronicles, our Book of Chronicles, you find Sefer Ido. It's a book of prophecy. Why wasn't it written down? So what Chazal tell us is that the prophecies that were recorded were the ones that would repeat themselves over and over again, the ones that would be needed for L'atid Lavo. It's a little bit like there was a philosopher, a Spanish-born philosopher named Santayana, who said those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. So too, the Sifrei Nevi'im, whenever there was a consensus that this particular Nevuah was going to be needed in the future, so it was written down to make sure that we're okay. But I'll tell you, there's a big risk with it. And I'll tell you what the risk is. The risk is one scary word called fundamentalism, right? I guess we're fundamentalists. We read Sefer Nevi'im, we believe it applies to our day today. But there's a negative aspect to the word fundamentalism, to be sure. It usually implicates what people do in the name of God, right? What terrible atrocities people do in the name of God, because they're sure they're right and they're sure the text is with them. I'll give you an example, and I have to say, when Rabbi Kelman asked me to speak, this was before the current events in Lebanon, so the speech really is not directly affected by what's going on in Lebanon today. This particular citation is, however, citation 2. Ve'elisha chalat kol yo asher yamut bo. So Elisha, the famous prophet, the student of Eliyahu Navi, Vayered Elav Yoash Melch Yisrael. So Yoash, the father of Yeravam II, who was a pretty firm guy, actually, as far as northern kings went. Vayev Kalpana Vayomer, Avi Avi Rechev Yisrael Ufarashav, which means you're dying and we're in big trouble, because without you, we got no chance. The enemy at the time was Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, capital city, Damascus. Vayomer lo Elisha, kach keshet, go get a bow. V'chitzim, and arrows. V'yikach elav keshet v'chitzim. So he went to get bow and arrows. V'yomer lemelech Yisrael, harkev yadcha ala keshet. So draw back your hand on the bow. V'yarkev yado, v'yasem Elisha yadav al yidei amelech. So Elisha places his hands on the drawn back hands of the king. V'yomer ptacha chalon keima v'yiftach. He says, open the window. He opens the window. So Radak is curious how he opens the window if his hands drawn back, but it's not that big of a question. Vayomer Elisha Yirei, fire. Vayor, and he fires. Vayomer and Elisha says, Chet Shua Ladunai, V'chet Shua Baram. The arrow of salvation belongs to God, and the arrow of salvation, Baram, means will land in Aram, which is Syria. V'hikita et Aram ba'feik ad kalan. You will destroy Aram completely until it is over. Vayomer, and then Elisha says, Kach achitim, take these arrows, Vayikach, and he takes them. Vayomer lemelech Yisrael, Hach arza. I want you to smash them on the ground. The symbolism, we don't know, but we'll find out that the king does understand the symbolism.
Vayach shalosh pa'amim vayamo. So he takes the arrows, he smashes them down on the ground three times, he stops. Like Tzof alav Isha Elohim vayomer, and Elisha is not pleased. Vayomer lahakot chamesh o sheish pamim. I wanted you to smash it five or six times. Ati kita rama kalei, because then you would have destroyed Syria completely. Vatash shalosh pamim taket aram. What that means is, for whatever reason, Yoash knew exactly what Elisha had planned. The idea was to destroy Syria completely. And Yoash intentionally strikes the ground three times with it, which says, I'll go to war with them, but it's not going to be a total war. I'm not going to wipe them out. Now, we're not told what the considerations of Yoash are. Yoash was a good king, honestly. He was a good, good king. Even by religious standards, he really wasn't too bad. Was the motivation the same as Shaul for not destroying Amalek completely? We don't know. Is there any connection between what's going on today? I don't know. And that's the difficulty of Nevuah. You see, sometimes the Nevi'im themselves didn't know how to interpret what they were saying, especially as things got later. Daniel didn't know what he was dreaming. It wasn't until the angels came and told him that he was able to understand. So there's a problem with fundamentalism, which is A, it's very difficult to interpret the prophecy, and B, it's very difficult to interpret your current situation, and then even more so difficult to figure out whether a specific Nevuah applies. And that's just a humbleness, which means I believe in omnisignificance. I really do. All Orthodox Jews really do. All traditional Jews really do. The words of the prophets are words to us. The humbleness is not believing that they don't all apply. The humbleness is knowing which applies when and to whom. So with that in mind, I'd like to tell you a personal story. I know I said it was a Tanakh shiur, so I'll get there eventually. My last page actually says Tanakh shiur starts here, so it won't be too long in the end. I want to read you from source 3 first, and I have to say, I heard Rabbi Kelman speak this morning in Or HaChaim, and also Rabbi Breuer speak, and the two of them specifically cover a lot of ground that I'm covering, so if this is repeat, I apologize, but it's a great gemara, and I'd like to read it to you. Source 3. Shuv Pamachat Ayu Olim Yushalayim. There was a group of rabbis that went up to Yushalayim. I'm sure everybody knows this story, but I love to read it. It's a great read, and it fits really nicely in with my shiur. This was Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva. Kevan shigiyu lahar tzofim karubi vehem. So when they got to Har Tzofim, they ripped their clothes. Kevan, because they saw the destruction of the temple. Kevan shigiyu lahar abayit ra'u shual shiyatzam ibeit kodshei kodashim itchiluhim bochim. So they saw a fox come out of the Beit HaMikdash, which means it was totally destroyed. Rabbi Akiva mitzachek. Rabbi Akiva thought it was funny. No, that's not fair. It's a bad translation. Rabbi Akiva laughed. Amru lo mipnei ma'atam mitzachek. So they said to him, why are you laughing? Amru lahem mipnei ma'atam bochim. How come you're crying? Amru lo makom shekatvu bo avazar karev yumad. It says in the Torah that any strange person will come, will be put to death, or perhaps in this case will simply die. Now there are the prophecy about foxes running through the destroyed city and the destroyed temple. We're not supposed to cry? Amru lahem. So Rabbi Akiva said to him, L'chein ani mitzachek. For that very reason, I'm laughing. Dichtiv ve'ayid ali yedim ne'amanim et Uriah kohen et Zechariah ben Yeverchiyahu. By the way, Dr. Breuer said something brilliant today, which I want to emphasize. Most prophecies are not future-telling prophecies. Most prophecies simply reveal what you don't know is going on now. For instance, when Yeshayahu tells you that you're walking around in his temple, you think you're bringing sacrifices, and your hands are spread out to God, and everybody is okay. But God is telling you that your hands are covered in blood. That's not a future prophecy. That's a revelatory prophecy. In this case, we actually have something of a future prophecy, because it's quoting two prophets that are not alive in Yeshayahu's time. So Rabbi Akiva goes on, I don't understand, why is Yeshayahu comparing Uriah to Zechariah, two prophets? Uriah b'mikdash rishon, v'zechariah b'mikdash sheni. They're talking about two different temples. So why combine their prophecies together? What point could you possibly make about two periods of time which are so far away? So the Torah, or the Navi in this case, Yeshayahu, wanted to combine the prophecy of Zechariah with the prophecy of Uriah. But Uriah, because of you and your sins, so the fields of Jerusalem, I'm sorry, the field
Jerusalem, Zion, or the temple, like fields, will be plowed under. There will come a time when old and young will sit in the streets of Jerusalem. I was a little worried because I have two prophecies in front of me, so I wasn't sure that Zechariah, the good news prophecy, was going to come true. But when it turns out Urias has come true and Jerusalem is taken down because of us, I know that Zechariah's prophecy will come true and Jerusalem will be rebuilt. Thank you, Akiva. So here's the personal story. 1987, I remember Tisha B'Av very well because I really got it. You know how sometimes you go to the Kotel and it's like amazing and you feel the presence of God and you have an amazing connection. And sometimes you go to the Kotel and you're like, that's nice. You know, I had a good davening. Is that just me or does everybody get it every time? Or like sometimes you really connect and sometimes you less connect. I don't think anybody goes to the Kotel and says, you know, a bunch of stones, but sometimes you really feel strongly about it. And life, I guess, you know, is a series of roller coasters up and down like the stock market. And sometimes you're a little closer and sometimes you're further away. 1987, somehow I got Tisha B'Av. I didn't greet anybody and it wasn't a fake. I was introspective and sorrowful when I went to listen to Eicha. And I was living in Givat Mordechai at the time. I don't know if you know where that is. Yerushalayim, right above where, on the other side of the mountain from Bayit Gad. And I had the following problem. And in order to explain to you the following problem, I'd like to do the following. It would have been really good if I had like a PowerPoint presentation, but I'd like you, if you would, either close your eyes or imagine the following. Has anybody come into the airport in Lod, touched down, and then either taken a taxi or a bus or rented a car and gone up the one road to Yerushalayim? Is that an experience that only I, if other people had that experience? Is that... You don't have to be shy with me. Or at some point, gone from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim on the one road. And as you're coming past Mevaseret Zion, you're coming up that last hill, and you see the Ramotz first. The mountains covered in buildings and people. And is it beautiful? I don't know who made the law that all of Jerusalem had to be Jerusalem stone, which only has one exception, which is the indoor pool right next to Gan HaPalmon, by the way, which is like this big white building. But everywhere else, it's all Jerusalem stone, and it glows. And if you're coming in the right time of the day, and then you get up there, and Yerushalayim spreads out before you. I mean, do you think David HaMelech ever could have imagined such a thing? David HaMelech talks about Yerushalayim. Do you think he ever would have imagined what we see today? Have any of you ever walked through the streets of Yerushalayim, bought a falafel, got out of the way of some old lady or some old guy or some kids who were running down the street and sort of pushing you out of the way, or got on an incredibly crowded bus with people schmoozing and talking? It's a beautiful feeling. Mamash, it's a beautiful feeling. And I had a problem. I was like in the zone on Tisha B'Av. And if I walked outside, the walk home from shul after Eicha to home, and I was happy because I was living in my apartment in Givat Mordechai. I don't know what to tell you. Rav Kelman mentioned this before, so I'd like to take you to it. If you have a sitter, you could open up to Mincha. And Rav Kelman hinted to it today because there's a tefillah that I don't know what to do with it. Nachem Adonai Eloheinu et avelei Tzion v'et avelei Yerushalayim. This is, if you're on the arts course, it's page 240. V'et ir ha'avela v'achareva, the city which is destroyed, habzuya, which is shamed, v'ashomema. It's not Jerusalem, I know. Ha'avela mibli v'neho, it has no buildings, v'achareva mimonoteha, v'abzuya mikvoda, v'ashomema me'en yoshev. V'hi yoshevet roshach hafui kisha kara shelo yalada. What Jerusalem is that talking about? It's not my Jerusalem. There's a cognitive dissonance that occurs to us, we Jews living today. We pray for the building of Jerusalem. We pray that God takes us back to Israel, but all you have to do is get on a plane. All you have to do is walk through the streets of Yerushalayim and feel the pleasure of the children running through the streets. I didn't read you the rest of the pasuk. It was old men on sticks, children with their pleasure, the song of Kol Sason Kol Simcha. Anybody been to a wedding in Yerushalayim? It's a beautiful thing. So how do you say this prayer? Monday is Shir Shel Yom. Somebody help me out. I don't have it right in front of me. Yifei Nof, Misos Kol Haaretz, Har Tzion, Yarkatei Tzafon, Kiryat Melech Rav, Elohim Bar Menodea Nodalim Iskav. Kasher shamanu, kain ra'inu, b'ir Adonai tzvaot, b'ir Eloheinu elohim yichonenu ad olam sela. I could sing those words today. All of you could sing those words today. Just take that drive up to Yerushalayim. Elohim yichonenu ad olam sela. So we have this cognitive dissonance, and it's beyond just the practical. It gets onto the messianic. How do I feel that the Messiah has not come, that the time of redemption is not here, and yet, wow, looks great. So I'll tell you what I did, which was a bad solution. I waited till the middle of the night, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I walked to the Kotel from Givat Mordechai, which first of all, I have to tell you, is a long walk. And second of all, there were no people out. So I tried to imagine that it was somehow Shomema. I don't know if it was a great solution. I think the usual solution is something you could tell me. How do we usually, as Jews living either in diaspora in Israel, how do we usually resolve the problem of Israel is as beautiful, probably more beautiful today than it was ever before? Gam Chizkiyahu's time, Gam Yoshiyahu's time, probably Gam David HaMelech's time. So actually another way, before I get to the solution which I think most of us take, is to imagine that all of those words apply only to Har Tzion, which means the Beit HaMikdash. And the fact that there's the Dome of the Rock, which, if you don't mind me saying, from a pretty standpoint, is pretty. It's a beautiful building. It's like listening to people, like sometimes with a German accent. So I grew up, I don't know about Canada, the United States, like they always had the Nazi movies. So whenever I hear a German accent, so I automatically think, you know, oh, it's something bad about it. There's a bad connotation, nothing bad about the German language at all. We tend to have the same sort of visceral feeling about the Arabic language. But anybody who goes to Israel and listens to a Sephardi, I mean a real Sephardi from Yemen, knows that their language is guttural almost to the far more than us Ashkenazim. And it's a beautiful language. We love it when the Sephardim talk it. When the Arabs talk it, we get an immediate sense that there's something wrong. But to get beyond that, that Dome of the Rock, that's pretty. And underneath the Dome of the Rock, which probably none of us has been in, but maybe, is a big rock. It's a big, big rock. Evan Masua Bonim Hayatala Rosh Pina. And the Jews going up there today. And of course, I know many Rebbeim that I had, Rav Lichtenstein, would surely disagree with me. He speaks about the spiritual need for Mashiach, and there's no doubt about it. But I think there's another way that we tend to solve this cognitive dissonance, which is the following words. Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, right? I'll tell you an interesting story about Rav Amital. Rav Amital does not say, and where is it, of course? Where do we put Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu? So that's Avinu Shabbat Shemayim Tzur Yisrael V'Golo. It's in our prayers. And I'll tell you an interesting story. Rav Amital doesn't say that. So would you like to know why? It's a great reason why. He says, because it's in the Shemona Esrei. Here, listen. Et semach David avdecha meirat tatzmeach karno tarum bishvatecha kidu shvachek vinchalayom. So Rav Amital is telling something incredibly deep, which is we tend to think that we need some extra prayer. And by the way, I'm not poskening and I'm not suggesting what you should do. And it's a beautiful prayer and I say it myself. Especially if you're in a shul where everybody's saying it, you don't say it. So you kind of look like you're not into it. So that's a dangerous thing to do. But I'll just tell you what Rav Amital said. And nobody is doubting Rav Amital's Zionism. So I think it's safe for him not to say it. So he says, sometimes we imagine that we need extra prayers as if somehow our longings for Israel are somehow different than the longings of Chazal when they put together, or Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, when they put together the tefillot. But the tefillot have the same longings that we do because the people yearn for the same thing. And of course, the words are, if you take a look quickly at source 4, 5, and 6, I'll just do a little bit from them. The idea of Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu comes right from Tanakh. Yirmiyahu is the biggie as far as Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu. Hine yamim ba'im. Behold, days are coming. Nu Mashem. V'hakimoti l'David semach tzadik. I will raise up or establish for David a semach tzadik. Anybody want to help me translate the word semach there? A flourishing. Yeah, a growth doesn't sound too good. That sounds kind of negative. But a flourishing is beautiful. U'malach melech. That's him. That's the Tzemach Tzadik. V'hiskil, and he will be successful. V'asa mishpat utztaka ba'aretz. Yechezkel has very similar. Take a look in source 5. Bayomahu atzmiach keren levei Yisrael ulcha etein pitchon peh betolcham v'yedu ki ani Adonai. And in Tehillim, we'll skip just to the end, although there's some cool stuff here, which is psukim that you probably recognize. Actually, I'd like to start from Pasuk Yud Dalet, because that word menucha is a key word as far as messianism goes. The Avudrahum points out that the word menucha, which is in our mincha prayers on Shabbat, are all about the final resting, or Uvnucha Yomar Shuva Hashem Revotafa Yisrael. Well, now I'll skip down to Pasuk Yud Zayin. Sham Etzmiach Keren David Arachti Nerem Shichai. It's not a new idea, of course. The idea of Tzemach and Keren is a prophecy that's been a long time. So I believe, and you know, feel free to like argue with me all the way, but I think that what we do today is that we have Israel where it is, and it feels good, and it looks incredible, and yet we're not there, and we don't know quite why we're not there. So we come up with this idea, which I hate to say is almost apologetic. Where she used to be thought of the beginning of the flowering of the redemption, which means I can say the redemption is on the way based on the state of Israel and what I've seen. But I can't say Mashiach has actually come because it doesn't feel like exactly what Mashiach is supposed to be. My question for you is exactly what is Mashiach supposed to be? So I'd like to quote in this case Lauren Schiffman. Actually, I'm not going to quote Lauren Schiffman because I don't have the book in front of me, but I'll tell you about what he says. He has this great book called The Eschatological Community of the Dead Sea Scrolls, The Study of the Rule of the Congregation. If anybody's done any Dead Sea Scroll studies, so the first thing you learn probably is it's called Serach HaYachad, which is their book on how to become a good Qumran sectarian. Whether they were Essenes or not is not really important, but they were certainly a breakaway sect. And he says that essentially there are two views of the eschaton, of the final days, of the Messiah, of the Mashiach. One is restorative, and the other one is utopian. The utopian is very, very popular in mystical channels, and both show up in Tanakh. The restorative, however, we've had the restorative is when Mashiach will take us back to the way things used to be. In fact, I believe Eicha pretty much ends off with that, right? Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuva chadesh ameinu kikedem. Which kedem days are we referring to? We're talking about messianic days. Which kedem days are we talking about? So here, and I'm going to skip over it just a little bit. Let me see, should we skip over it? You know what? It's interesting because Dr. Breuer cited this very text. I think it's worth looking at the text. So if you turn over the page in item number 7. So Amar Rav Chiya bar Ava, Amar Rav Yochanan, Kol Hanaviim Kulam lo nitnabu'u el limot Mashiach.
So there's a big machloket that I'm not going to get into right now exactly what Olam Haba is.
But let's get to Shmuel. Pilga to Shmuel, and it's an pliga to Shmuel. It's an argument on Shmuel. Damar Shmuel ein ben olam hazeh l'imot Mashiach ela shibud malchiyut bilvad. The only difference between messianic times, there will be no change to. The only difference will be that Israel will be free. The Rambam, who is the ultimate rationalist, loves this stuff. Loves it. So he says in section 8.
Don't think that the world's going to change at all.
The world will be exactly as it is.
Of course, that's not entirely fair because it wasn't all the Chachamim, right? It's just Shmuel's opinion. So the Rambam's passing it after Shmuel's opinion, but he's presenting it as a fait accompli, as a single opinion.
You know what? Let's skip down to the last line, slightly smaller font. Boto azman, lo yesham lo rav, in messianic times will be no famine, velo milchama, velo kina, v'tacharut, and no big jealousy, and there'll be no competition. But I don't understand. He just said world's not going to change. I assume world's not going to change. Human nature's not going to change. So he says something which I think is astounding, and it could be a misinterpretation. So feel free to tell me if you don't like it, but I'll do what I can do with it.
Because goodness will have a massive effect.
It's the ultimate in peer pressure. It's not that evil won't exist, if you'll allow me to interpret the Rambam that way, and I think that's what the Rambam is saying. Evil may exist, but tova will be mushpat harbe. It's not that there won't be bad people who sometimes kill. Maybe it'll happen. Bad things happen. Maybe people will steal, people will be poor, or maybe somebody will be a kleptomaniac, or somebody will just steal because they're not a very nice person. But the tova will be so mushpat that they will become individuals, they will disappear, they'll be batel barov. Messianic times doesn't mean that we're a bunch of zombies. Messianic times means that there's no shibun malchio. And the reason why there's no shibun malchio is because we come to a time when people say, hey, maybe attacking people is not a good idea. Maybe let's figure out where we want to live, and let's live there and let well enough alone. Now, of course, that's not the only view of messianism. There's the view which is championed by the Ramchal and Derech Hashem. That's where nature changes altogether. Where things, people, when they, every time they do a mitzvah, it's beautiful. Read Derech Hashem. Every time people does a mitzvah, their guf is affected by their neshama, so their guf actually starts to glow like fireflies or something. It's beautiful stuff. And I would argue that the modern view of the modern state of Israel may fall into those terms as well. There's a famous medrash about how the third temple will be built with diamonds. I believe it's a Gemara, actually. I believe it actually gets into Gemara. So some people picture that the temple will fall from the sky built as diamonds. I don't feel that way. It doesn't mean I'm right. It just means it's not the way I feel. I used to work in a place called the Bursa Yehalom, which is down at the end of Ramat Gan, right before you get into Tel Aviv. And their Haredim is a very Haredi place because it's the diamond exchange. So essentially, it's, if you know Tel Aviv during the summer, it's very scantily dressed women and a lot of Haredim. It's a very strange combination. They used to be actually at that same Tzomet with Tzomet Elite. Does anybody know Tzomet Elite? They knocked it down, by the way. Elite's not there. They sold it off. But used to stand there, and there was this smell. All the buses in the world were coming down Rehov Jabotinsky, and there was this smell of deep, dark chocolate and diesel fumes. It was the weirdest combination you've ever smelled your entire life. And that was similar to Busay Elamim. So how do I know that the prophecy doesn't mean that with diamonds the third temple will be built? Are we supposed to wait till the temple falls from the sky? Or are we supposed to walk up to the temple mount and take the stones and build it? And I don't know what the answer is, although I do know a little bit which way I lean. If you walk through the Cardo, you know what they have there now in a glass box or a plastic box? There's a menorah there. And students always ask me, so Rabbi Levi, how come we can't build the temple? I said, who said you can't? How come we can't build a menorah? I think they did. Who said you can't build in our own? I don't know, maybe you can. How do we view the Messianic days? Will we bring it ourselves? Or must we be passive until it comes to us? And I told you I'd finally get to my Tanakh shiur, so here's my Tanakh shiur. But the subject, of course, is really Zionism. And here I want to take you to the book of Ezra. Let me see if I'm still on track as far as my notes go. There's... my synopsis is a little confusing because I say, you know, the Zionist movement failed. But the truth is, there's a little problem there. The question is, what's the first Zionist movement? It's always hard to say what the first one is, what the second one, the third one is. I would say, anybody want to think about what they think the first Zionist movement was? Can you not hear me without the mic? I'm sorry. Take it with me, okay. So, anybody, the first Zionist movement, the first time that people make Aliyah, yeah? Can you, well, in the Chumash, where in the Chumash? You mean the Moroccan? Well, that's interesting, because then we have a failed Aliyah, right? The first generation was a failed Aliyah. The second generation was a successful Aliyah. But I would say I would go back earlier than that. Anybody want to go earlier for... Yes, in the back? Avram Avinu. Oh, that's true. Well, Terach maybe was a failed Aliyah, because he was on the way of Israel and he stopped off at Haran. So that's very possible. And Terach should not be underestimated, because it says, Eila toldo Terach, never Eila toldo Avram, which means that it pays, you know, no matter how great somebody is, it always pays to have somebody's father. I always say Terach was looking for God. He was just looking for him in all the wrong places. But at least he was looking for God. Avram Avinu would probably be, for sure, the first person who made a successful Aliyah. And then it was a little hard. Economy was bad, so he went down to Egypt. He made Yeridah, but then he came back. It's not so bad. The Chumash is full of Aliyot and failed Aliyot. It's full of Zionist movements and failed Zionist movements. Just to go through a few, so we have some. Menashe, King Menashe, is in source number... You know, Rabbi Kelman, I took off my watch, and now I can't find it. How much time do I have left? Good 20 minutes. Oh, I could do a lot in 20 minutes, I hope. So, good king, bad king, Menashe. So, you probably all know King Menashe, Chizkiyahu's son. So much of my statement about good fathers, bad kids. I guess it doesn't always work that way. And in fact, there's a great chapter in Chizkiyahu which just deals with these four possibilities. Good father, bad son. Good father, good son. Bad father, bad son. Bad father, good son. I think I got that right. It's binary. It's computers. But I think I got it right. It's a beautiful chapter in Chizkiyahu. In Yechezkel, I'm sorry. So Yechezkel has a really, really bad son named Menashe. So I'll read a little bit from him, but I can't read you from him in Sefer Melachim. Because in Sefer Melachim, he's positively unredeemable. He is the worst of the worst. Blood flows through the streets of Jerusalem. There's nothing to talk about. He is going to you know where. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. And he's listed as one of the people in Chelek who's not getting Olam Haba.
Kol Yisrael Yesh L'mchelek Olaba, except for a few people, and Menashe is right up there. But Divrei Yamim paints him a little bit differently. He actually does tshuva. He gets pulled into exile, and he does tshuva in exile. And the Gemara in Chelek itself discusses whether he was a good person, whether he was a bad person, a shear for a different thing. But I'll show you something interesting in this pasuk. Vayavei Adonai Aleihem et Sarei Atzava Asher L'melech Ashur. So because of Menashe's bad acting, because he was such an evil king, so Assyria, this is 100 years later, Assyria is no longer in the picture, Assyria is in the picture. The king of the time, by the way, is Ashurbanipal. I'll explain to you, this is significant, I'll explain to you in a second. Vayil kedu Menashe b'chochim, v'yasru b'nechoshot time, and he puts him in Nechoshet, is brass. I hate to gross everybody out, but what they used to do is they used to take a handcuff, but it wasn't a handcuff, it was a jaw cuff, and they would drill a hole through, we have pictures of this actually, cut into stone. They would drill a hole through the jaw and then put the handcuffs through the cheek and into the jaw, and they would drag the kings and anybody else they wanted to drag with these essentially jaw cuffs. It sounds disgusting, and I'm sure it was, and I'm sure it was embarrassing to say the least, besides being painful. And that's the word nechushat, that's the word nechushtayim. Vayolichehu bavela. But the capital city of Ashur is not Bavel. The capital city of Ashur was... anybody? That is exactly right. Nineveh, which gets into the whole Yonah story, but let's not get there, about prophecies that you don't necessarily want to come true or you're afraid of. So I have to tell you what Menachem Liebtag says. Rav Menachem Liebtag says that this is indication that this is this galut. This is actually when the galut started. Everything else is icing on the cake. It's a very difficult shita, but he knows it's the word bavel, which is absolutely true. I have a more scientific explanation, more historical explanation. They're both certainly true, because the authors were no dummies. They spoke historically in the Nevi'im, and they also spoke to look behind the curtain and see what was really going on. I can tell you that the year was 652. 652, there was a king. Actually, before the king that was active at this time was a king named Esarhaddon. Anybody ever see the movie Contact, by the way, with Jodie Foster? So if you remember, the guy who was funding everything was called Esarhaddon. That's the joke, because there was a famous king of Assyria who was long-lived. In fact, Esarhaddon was the one who took over after Sancheirav was murdered, as our Navi says that he was, by his children. So Esarhaddon takes over, and Esarhaddon comes up with a great idea. At this time, Ashur was preeminent, and Bavel, which was down by, well, modern-day Iraq and lower, all the way down to the Gulf there. What's it called? Was at the Persian Gulf. All of that area was subjected to Assyrian rule. So Esarhaddon says, you know what, I'm going to set up two kings. The primary guy, my primary son, he will rule in Nineveh, and his name is Ashurbanipal. And the other king is Shamashum Ishkin, I believe. I'm not sure, you have to look it up. And he was a brother of Ashurbanipal, and let him rule over Bavel in Bavel, which is a city which is not too far from Baghdad, but mostly destroyed today because it sits on a water table and most of it was completely destroyed. It's really not, you can't dig much of it up. And what happened is the southern king got into the whole Bavel culture and he rebelled against Assyria. So Assyria from 652 to 648 has to conquer southern Bavel, and he sets up rulership in Bavel. Now, the Navi is aware of this, of course. Of course, all the outlying states, like Israel, figure, oh, this is a great time. While brothers are fighting brothers, this is a good time to stop paying taxes and to rebel. They were wrong. And Menashe got dragged to Bavel for a little redemption. So, or at least, hopefully, a little redemption, although certainly machloket. Some would say, when he brought back to Israel, that that was his Zionist movement. Of course, he didn't get dragged there by himself. He no doubt got dragged there with tens of thousands or 100,000 Jews. And when they came back, according to Menachem Liebtag, that was something of a return from Zion. There's another one in the next source, which is Yirmiyahu, which, if I went into now, first of all, would depress too much of us, which is Gedaliah ben Achikam. I just want to shock you. I hate to do this as a teaser, because I can't get into it, because it's a shear in and of itself. But I have to read you the source, because I have to scare you. Everybody knows that after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Israel, there were going to be 70 years of exile. Everybody knows that. Except Yirmiyahu himself, who made the prophecy. In Yirmiyahu Perek Mem, it says, "Vani hinini yoshev v'mitzvah la'amod l'fnei akasdim." This is in Yirmiyahu talking. This is Gedaliah talking. Gedaliah was set up as a ruler by the Babylonians. Of course, people said, oh, we don't want anything to do with that state of Israel. Look who supports it. Bavel, I don't want anything to do with it. But Gedaliah convinced people that even though the Kazdim were their supporters, it was still worthwhile having a state of Israel. Asher yavo elenu v'atem, and you, I want all you Jews, isfu yayin, gather wine, v'kayitz, and grain, v'shemen, v'simu b'chlehem, v'shvu barechem, asher tfastem. The Jews were reconquering cities. This is only a few years after the structure of the temple. maybe two. And all the Jews are coming back to Zion. You thought it lasted 70 years. It didn't last 70 years. V'gam kol ha'yudim asher b'moav u'b'vnei Amon u'v'edom. All the Jews that were Moab and Ammon and Edom, v'asher b'chol ha'artzot and in every single nation, shamu ki natan melech b'bavel sherit liyuda. The king of Babel decided, you know what? Let's put the Jews back in Israel. Now, no doubt he was doing it for political reasons. But so what? And they came back from all the places where they were exiled. They have a prophet, his name was Yirmiyahu, he supported it. They have a king, not a king, but a ruler named Gedaliah ben Achikam. They've got money, they're conquering cities, they have jurisdiction from the major power at the time. Of course, you know what happens, right? What happens? And who assassinated him? A Jew. Yishmael ben Netanya. Yishmael is not, it was a Jewish name, of course, like Rabbi Yishmael. And you know why he assassinated him? Because they knew about the plot. They intercepted the letter. It was all plot by Balas, the king of Ammon, because Ammon wasn't happy about the fact that Israel was getting the political advantage. He wanted the political advantage. So he said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do the whole setup. We're going to kill the king, and we're going to kill the Kazdim, and that'll turn the Kazdim against the Jews. And they intercepted the letter. And a guy comes over, Ben Kareach, I don't remember his name, Yonatan Ben Kareach, I believe, and he comes over and he says, listen, Gedaliah, this guy's going to murder you. You know what he says? I can't believe a Jew would shoot me in the back. How could you believe such a thing? So that was the exile. I want to talk about the next Zionist movement that failed or didn't fail, and it's in Ezra, where we started off from the beginning, of course, and that was, I don't know, 40 minutes ago. I want to show you. See, I promise you, the book of Ezra is on my last page. The name of the book is almost incomprehensible. You would think the book of Ezra is all about Ezra. Ezra doesn't show up until chapter 7. The problem is it's impossible to gauge how much time it goes by between chapter 6 and chapter 7. It's a little bit like when Miriam dies, right? The pasuk before Miriam dies, you're in the second year of the desert, and then all of a sudden Miriam's dead, you're 40 years later. The Torah skips 38 years because, not that nothing was happening, but because I guess nothing new was happening, nothing that God felt was important enough for us to know. The numbers themselves in Sefer Ezra are shocking. I don't have them on your sheets, but there was a first Aliyah. It was not during Ezra's time. The leader of the Jewish people was none other than a guy named Zerubbabel. They had a Kohen. The Kohen's name was, I'm sorry, it slipped my mind, but it's right here, Yeshua ben Yotzadak. He was the Kohen Gadol. They had Nevi'im. They didn't have one Navi. They had three powerhouse Nevi'im. They were Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And they had jurisdiction of the king Cyrus, and they were all back in Israel. And I want to show you the excitement of what it was like to come back to Israel at that time. If we take a look at source 11. Vayakam Yeshua ben Yotzadak ve'achav konim uzubavel ben Shatiel ve'achav vayivnu et mizbeach Elohi Yisrael alot alav alot katu b'torat Moshe ish Elohim. We're re-establishing the temple just like Moshe told us. Vayachinu ha-mizbeach ha-mechonav. I'm going to get to the next sentence in a second. The only problem is the numbers. Let me take you to the numbers. Do you know how many people made Aliyah during this time, during Zerubbabel's time? Count the numbers. I'm not going to do it here because it'll take too long. Thousands of men. Actually, 42,350 approximately. Read through. So what would that put us at a total Aliyah if you count women and children? 250,000? 250,000 Jews come back from Babel. 250,000 Jews in the time of Cyrus, approximately the year 530. I'm afraid if you look in chapter 7, it's not like that. All of a sudden, Ezra is chosen, and he comes, and he's got 70 people here, 50 people there, maybe 120 people there, a total of about, I think, 2,000, maybe. By sheer force of numbers, Ezra's Aliyah is a total failure. And if you analyze the names in these two chapters of Ezra, as well as in Nehemiah Perek Yud Bet, you'll find that we've lost 100 years. It's the famous question, by the way. How long was the old temple, how long was the second temple up for? 420 years? So if it's built in the year 517 before the Common Era and falls in the year 70, BC, and it falls in the year 70 Common Era, that's almost 600 years. So what happened to 420? So if you look at the OU website, so they'll post-date the building of the Beit HaMikdash to 400. That is an unwise thing to do. Nobody accepts that. It's really not in the scholarly world. 100 years are completely lost. More. About 120, 160. Is that right? Is it 160? I have something to depress you. It's not the year 5,766. It's not. It's a long shiur going through it. It's a very interesting shiur that I've heard from Menachem Liebtag, and it's an unbelievable shiur. Between chapter 6 and chapter 7, you've lost 160 years. There's an intifada. That's what it says in the second pasuk. But you know what? That didn't slow the Jews down. Take a look in pasuk Gimel. They put it up nice and solid. Because they were in a great deal of fear. So yeah, they were in fear, but it didn't stop them from building a temple. And then after a while, the other people wanted to join in. They weren't Jews. They were probably what's left of the Sumerians today. And they complain, and then the son of, either the son, Darius the First, or perhaps Artaxerxes, writes a Ktav Sitnan. Everything starts to go badly for the Jews. But here's the great tragedy. The great tragedy is not that we lost 150 years of history. Here's the shocking thing. Look at section 12. I want to get back to Zerubbabel. Uvnei Yoshiyahu habachor Yochanan hasheni Yoyakim hashishi Tzidkiyahu v'revi Shalom. So Yehoyakim was the actual line. He was the selected king. Uvno Yoyakim Yechonyahu. He was the one who was dragged away in chains after 3 months. But he was kept in exile, by the way, by the Babylonian kings. In fact, we have Babylonian documentation written on stone that says, I am hereby giving a certain amount of bread to Yechonyahu in exile, the king in exile. Babel thought that he was the real king. The reason why they were keeping out of Israel was to suppress any Zionist movements. They established Tzidkiyahu because Tzidkiyahu was a puppet of the Babylonian king. Uvnei Yechonyahu Asir. Yechonyahu was in prison. Shaltiel Beno. His name was Shaltiel. Umalkiram Ufdaya. Fdaya was Shaltiel's son. And Pdaya's son was Zerubbabel. I know we always say Zerubbabel ben Shaltiel, but don't be fooled by Tanakh. Tanakh will very often skip generations. Zerubbabel was in the direct line of the king. And if you don't think people were excited about it, look at Zechariah, who was prophesizing at that time. Ko amar Adonai Tzvot, im b'drachai telech, v'im b'shvartai tishmor, v'gam atat tadin et beiti, v'gam tishmor chatzerai, v'natati l'cha malchim bein ha'omdim ha'ele. Shema na Yoshua Kohen. I want you to listen, you Kohen Gadol. Atav reyecha yoshvim lefanecha, ki anshe mefot, mofet ema, ki hinini mevi et abdi tzemach, because I'm bringing my servant Tzemach. If that's not enough proof for you, take a look at the next pasuk. Making the Kohen Gadol. There's a man called Tzemach. You know who they're talking about. Who are they calling Tzemach? Zerubbabel. Uvana Techal Hashem. He will build the temple, which he did. Zerubbabel, the son of Pedaya, the son of Shaltiel, the grandson of Yoshiyahu, was the king Tzemach. They know the prophecies. The temple was going up. Yeah, there were bad guys. There was an intifada. There was all kinds of strange stuff going on. But they were building a temple. The king told them, the king of Babel, or in this case, Koresh, told them they could build a temple. They had a king in the line of David. They had a Kohen Gadol. They had working, functioning prophets who could tell them where to put the temple. Is there any doubt? Kinani mevi'et abdi Tzemach? That they thought more than just Reshit Tzmicha Kulatenu. I assure you, they weren't thinking Reshit Tzmicha Kulatenu. And if you're curious about the use of the word Tzemach, look at the Radak. We won't read it inside. The Radak says the thing about Tzemach is that he grows slowly. Tzemach starts slowly from Yushalayim. And eventually he grows and becomes the Mashiach that we would expect him to be. They thought, they knew, they didn't think, they knew that Zerubbabel was the Melech Mashiach. So when you get a chance, open up to chapter 7 of Ezra. The king calls on Ezra, king in Persia, and he says, listen, I want you to go to Israel. Take a bunch of people with you. Flip the pages. There's no mention of Zerubbabel whatsoever. He's gone. I tell you, to my mind, that's scarier than knowing what happened to him. I would have been happy to hear that he died in a war. I would have been happy to hear that he was an evil guy.
that he did something bad to somehow not deserve to be the Mashiach. Chizkiyahu, we know there's a chazal about the story about how he should have said Shira, said Shir, how he didn't say Hallel when he saw the temple fall, when he saw Usher fall. Yoshiyahu, except he crossed across the border, that he didn't allow Mitzrayim to cross the border. I could tell you, if you asked Zechariah whether Zerubbabel was the Mashiach, I'll tell you, he said, yeah. But the problem is, we have no idea what happened to him. The Zionist movement, the one that brings 250 million Jews to Israel, fails. 250,000, thank you, Jews to Israel, fails. And we don't know why. I think that may be the message here of Sefer Zechariah, to be honest, of Sefer Ezra. There is no king anymore. The Kohen Gadol takes over. The problem is not correct in the time of the Chashmonaim, because when they take over, they did not give back the rulership to Beit David. And Beit David is lost. There will be movements to resurrect him, Beitar, Rabbi Akiva. But in Ezra, the Zionist movement from chapter 1 to chapter 6 is lost. Not that they weren't living in Israel. They were, some of them. But something happened and we don't know what it was. I'll take a little... How much time do I have left? 5 minutes? 3 minutes? So I'll take a little aside. Yoshiyahu. I want to talk a little about Yoshiyahu because he's in the keynote. You know what Yoshiyahu's... We know something about Yoshiyahu's mistake that even Chazal didn't know because we know a little bit about history. I hope that's not a terrible thing to say, but I'll say it. Yoshiyahu was stopping the king of Egypt from going up to do a battle at a place called Carchemish. We know the name from Devar Hayamim. And you would think that he was going up, that they were going up to battle Bavel. But they weren't. Well, I'm sorry, they were going up to battle Ashur. As Yoshiyahu's problem was Ashur, not Bavel. But they weren't. Usher was on the ropes. Yoshiyahu was sure, like Yonah was sure, that Usher was the worst, terrible, terrible, disgusting people you can imagine. Look in Sancheirib, look what they did. Bavel was a little bit of a peon. They were nothing. They were a little nation in the time of Yonah, and they were an uprising nation in the time of Yoshiyahu. The king of Mitzrayim goes to defend Usher, because the king of Mitzrayim did understand that if Usher falls, then there's nothing between his country and Bavel. So why did Yirmiyahu tell him not to go? Because sometimes it's hard to see the future. Mamash, we're sure who our enemies are, and we're sure who our friends are. We're sure. Except it doesn't always work that way. I have a piece from Orot. I'll end off with this, and I know it's not happy, but it is Tisha B'Av. I do have happy shirim, which I'll give at some other time. It's Orot HaMilchama. I strongly suggest reading it, although it's very difficult. And he says that at a time of war, you probably heard this from Soloveitchik regarding the Holocaust. After a time of terrible, horrible war, there's something called the building of Mashiach, when Semach David comes and Mashiach starts to flower. Because no society could live through a horror of war and not have Mashiach come. So we all know Rav Soloveitchik's piece about how essentially, to a certain extent, the state of Israel is to some extent a kapara for the neshamot that were lost. And Rav Kook here is sure that after the war that he's envisioned, the horror that he's envisioned, the Mashiach can't help but come. But you know what war he was talking about, right? World War I, not World War II. So I heard from Amital as follows. He said, listen, we can dream about Mashiach. I'm going to paraphrase quite a bit. We could dream about Mashiach. We can identify things and hope that Mashiach is coming. There's no doubt about it. We could even, I think, and this is me, not Rav Amital, we can work to try to make Mashiach come. We can predict that Mashiach is right around the corner. We can say Reshit Tzmichah Koteinu and really mean it. But now I'll quote Rav Amital. Even Rav Kook can't tell God when he's supposed to do his business. So to a certain degree, we wait. Have a nice Tisha B'Av, or meaningful Tisha B'Av.